Hello and welcome back to Album to Album, the Bowie Album Podcast with me, Arslan Mohammed. In this week's episode, we welcome back the mighty David Quantick to wax lyrical on Pinups, the 1973 album of covers that saw Ziggy being given the boot in style and Bowie taking time out of his increasingly bonkers life to kick ass with a high-octane set of influential covers. The tunes on this album are personal favourites, which Bowie fondly recalled soundtracking his days as a mod about town in mid-60s London. Here, he takes classics and deep cuts from the likes of the Yardbirds, Pink Floyd, The Who, The Kinks, The Merseybeats and more, and blasts them all out at full pelt. And he's backed here for the last time by remnants of the Spiders from Mars, who turn in a blistering performance, all the more remarkable for the fact that they knew this was to be their final album with Bowie. Because he just sacked them all publicly on stage, as you do, at the Hammersmith Odeon that July, which had not only traumatised them, but all his fans and pretty much everyone around him. But Bowie knew it was time to move on. Diamond Dogs, America, and a gargantuan drug habit were all in the offing, and whether intentionally or not, Pinups represented a clearing of the decks, a grateful thank you to the bands of his youth. And yeah, it was rough, it was raw, and it was a frenzied final message from Ziggy, who would shortly be joining Major Tom and the Laughing Gnome, floating around somewhere in outer space. So, recorded in the summer 1973, the album's got the heroic Mick Ronson, of course, as Bowie's main man on guitar, Ainsley Dunbar on drums, Mike Garson reprising his manic contributions to Aladdin Sane here on keyboards, and Trevor Boulder on bass. And also, it was the last album to be produced by Ken Scott, whose fondness for heavy bass and musty guitars was never more indulged by Bowie than on this LP. Soon, most of this team would be out of the picture, but as an impassioned, rambunctious, bombastic moment of pure glam energy and uniquely Bowie-esque eccentricity, Pinups is a monster. So now, in this conversation, you'll hear what me and David Quantick made of it, and I should point out that on the day of recording this interview, I was still down with a horrible cold, so I was doped to the eyeballs on Lemsip, and I sound really rather lugubrious, well, more than usual. Nevertheless, I hope you enjoy.
And if you venture down a marquee on a Sunday night, the Floyd with dear old Sid, or the Animals down Wimble Street at the Scene Club, Eel Pie Island, Rick-a-Tick Club for the Creation, or Reggie's Mob the Action. But the biggest buzz was back at the marquee. They dressed weeks out of date, but they did all the right stuff, Martha and Vandellas and all that. Lot of action on a night. They were our band, The Who.
Last time you were here, we talked about Hours, or we spent a lot of time not talking about Hours, which is rather reflecting the interview that you had with Bowie himself around that time. This time we're going to talk about an album that I'm certainly a lot more familiar with, and was actually one of the first David Bowie albums I ever got, which is Pinups. Pinups from 1973. Now, this is an album full of covers. It came out at the height of Ziggy Mania, and you said that you would like to talk about it. So what made you choose this particular album?
Just because I love it. When I first got into Bowie in the late 70s, I did it, like most people, by borrowing Bowie albums off my sister and my sister's friends and my girlfriend at the time. And Pinups was in there. So, out of canon, I think I heard Ziggy Stardust and Heroes and Pinups at the same time. And knowing very little about music, right. It's only from the sleeve notes I discovered it was a covers album. I didn't know a lot of the songs on it. And I just loved it. I didn't have anything to compare it to. So a lot of people now might go, oh, that version of such and such isn't as good as the original. But I didn't care because I hadn't heard the original. And I still really like it. I love the sound of it. It's one of the biggest, fattest 70s Bowie albums that he made. It's
full glam rock, isn't it?
Full glam rock, full stop.
Pumped up to the max.
It's the last album that most of the Spiders made. Yeah. And it's just them having fun. And this is what I would say about this would be my summary. It's the only fun record David Bowie ever made. He did not ever, with the exception of the novelty ones, right. He never made a fun album. They're always about the apocalypse or something like that, or doom or...
So I've never thought of that. I mean, you wouldn't classify, say, Let's Dance, for example, as a fun album or...
Let's Dance, superficially, is fun, but it's a melancholy song with a great production, Under the Moonlight, Serious Moonlight, and blah-de-blah. The rest of the album's a bit down. From the start, it's designed as, it starts with Rosalind with a great big... speedy beat. It's just Ronson's all over it. Ronson is fantastic on it. He's just enjoying it because they're playing their favorite songs. Ronson was a Jeff Beck clone when he started. Bowie's just playing the songs that he heard when he went to clubs. He used to see those bands in the 60s. He he's enjoying himself. I mean, he's always done, he always did at least one or two covers on every album. And this one is all covers. And it's perfect. You know, at the time, he recorded songs that didn't fit, a couple of Bruce Springsteen songs. But this is perfect. It's all bands who played the Marquee and similar clubs at the height of the British beat boom. There's no Beatles on it. There's no Stones on it. It's just mostly obscure bands, brilliant singles. In fact, I even went out and bought a compilation called Hard Up Heroes on Decca, which was released as a cash-in, because it's the original versions of those songs. It's a great album, Hard Up Heroes.
Does it replicate the track listing?
No, it doesn't. It's got other stuff on.
Right.
And it has a terrible cover, which is, you have to look up. Hard Up Heroes on Decca, the worst sleeve ever.
Well, there's a lot of competition for the worst sleeve
ever. It's not the worst sleeve ever, but it's...
You're taking back the worst sleeve. You're dialing back the worst sleeve ever.
It's the funniest picture of Van Morrison you'll ever see.
So Hard Up Heroes, this was the sort of the what today would be a Mojo cover CD.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's actually very good. I have it because it's got basically the debut singles by loads of people who are mostly on Decca. Steve Marriott, Van Morrison, Joe Cocker, loads of stuff. But a lot of it is things like the Mojos, Everything All Right, The Pretty Things. I mean, because of this album, Pinups, I've had a lifelong love of The Pretty Things.
This was your way in.
This was my way in. I'd know nothing about them, but I've seen The Pretty Things, I've met them, have all their records. And just the fact that Bowie, who... I used to be a student union DJ, and the people who liked rock hated Bowie. They said, he's not rock.
Yeah.
Well, this was baffling to me. I'm like, how can you listen to, I don't know, Ziggy Stardust and that insane and say he's not rock? And what they meant was he has no soul,
right.
That he's not authentic, all that nonsense, that he's fake.
That was the old chestnut from the 70s, wasn't it? He wasn't really part of like the denim and beard.
Yeah.
Because he was seen as being a bit of a, you know, lounge lizard, you know, skating over this, trying a bit of that.
It's the thing that Brian Ferry's been saying when talking about the reissued Roxy music. We weren't one of them. We've never been one of them. And it is. So he's always been an outsider. But what's interesting about this, and what's lovely, is that while he might be an outsider, he wasn't an outsider. He was part of the 60s music scene. He was so keen to be an R&B singer, to be a beat success. Nowadays, we think of 60s Bowie as, you know, that Anthony Newley novelty stuff. But he made an awful lot of, not great, but British beat singles.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff there. There was the Managed Boys, there was the Lower Third, there was, I think, the Buzz, wasn't it, the King Bees. I mean, all of these were sort of, I mean, as bands, fairly middling. But you can, his charisma and his sort of excitement really does come through. And they're doing the standard repertoire of, you know, like Muddy Waters,
yeah.
You know, Blues Boom stuff. I mean, there was nothing particularly exceptional there. But yeah, the track listing for Pinups really must have been the oral diet he was getting sort of in the mid-60s, going around the Marquee, the Ricky Tick and all these clubs.
It's beautiful. I mean, I just look at the song titles that he's writing on this, even the colours, the West Ham colours, you know, the blue and purple.
Was it? Of course, are they West Ham?
I guess it's the only football team I know. But it doesn't matter what you think of the songs. It's a great compilation tape. You must have enjoyed making the list that you've got two Who songs over on there. You've got The Pretty Things, you've got The Mojos, the slightly odd moments, you know, See Emily Play, which I love because it's so 70s. It's got the Varispeed Bowie vocals. It's got the Anthony Newley. It's a strange version. I'm sure Pink Floyd fans hate it, but it's really done with love. And yeah, bizarrely, in the 2000s, David Gilmour did a solo gig and Bowie sang Arnold Lane for him, which was nice.
I love that version, actually.
It's done really well. You know, he's really nice. People forget that Bowie's got a bit of Sid in him, as well as...
Like, you're right. It definitely comes through in See Emily Play, which is a bit alarming when you first encounter the Pinups version.
Yeah.
After the sort of fairly straight, you know, sort of typical 67 Pink Floyd version. But yeah, I mean, what's going on with that? It's all like, you know, very slowed down and...
It's got the vocals off, as I say, Quicksand, Bewley Brothers. It's got that Beatle thing of basically a string quartet stuck on the end. But yeah, thinking about it now, when you listen to some later 60s Bowie, there's definitely a bit of Sid in there, a bit of that quirky British Alice in Wonderland humour. But the best moment, and it's beautifully done and beautifully judged, is it ends with Where Have All the Good Times Gone?
Yeah.
When he prints the lyrics on the sleeve, which means he wants you to read them. And it's a great crunchy version. It's a great Kink song. Ray Davies loved it.
Really?
Yeah, he wrote the sleeve notes to one of the recent Bowie boxes. Yeah. He's clearly very flattered. They did Waterloo Sunset together at one of those endless Royal Festival Hall gigs too.
I remember seeing that on the White Room or something many, many years ago that he did Waterloo Sunset as well. But I mean, Again, I'm surprised there's not more crossover between Ray Davies and Bowie over the years, just because they can articulate something very shrewdly, a sense of place, a sense of a time, and so on. And that really does come across in Where Have All the Good Times Gone. It's like, you know, farewell to all that.
Yeah, it's a brilliant song, and doing a sad song as an ender is nicely done. I said it's a fun album, and the whole thing is a fun celebration. And way over the top. You listen to his vocals on Here Comes the Night.
Yeah.
He's just taking the mickey.
The interesting thing about this was that this album was recorded in France with the Spiders. Now, it was done pretty much immediately after he announced from stage that he's retiring Ziggy. And I've heard different stories about this, how much the band knew in advance. I think Ronson knew, perhaps. But certainly the rest of them were really annoyed. And he said over the years that Pinups was, when he's been in his, one of his more dismissive modes, oh, Pinups was really just something for the band to do, you know, just give them one last hooray. But to hear them going through these songs, knowing that this is their last big moment, is quite poignant, really.
They're not all on it. Who's?
No, they're not.
There's, I should know this. No, Ainsley Dunbar, Woody Woodmansey's not on it.
He isn't.
No, and Woody was one of the, basically, like all bands, the Spiders have got two who are close to the boss, which is Ronson and Woodmansey, and two who aren't, which is, you know, Boulder, and there isn't another one, I've got that wrong. Garstles. But yeah.
Is Garstles on this?
I can't remember. Yes, he is, actually. So it's the Spiders band. It's the Aladdin Sane band. I got a great story Woody Woodmansey told me about Mick Ronson walking out on the Spiders. Do you know it?
No.
It's sort of the early 70s, and Bowie's reinventing himself as Hype, and they're all dressing up in costumes, and the Ziggy concept is coming in. And Mick Ronson can't take it anymore. And he walks off to the station, and Bowie says to Woody, go back and get him. So he goes to the station, and they're sat at whatever station it is, Bromley Central. And Woody's going, what's wrong, Mick? And he goes, I can't take this. He goes, what do you mean you can't take this? It's all fake, isn't it? It's not real. And he goes, what are those boots you're wearing? Woody says to Mick, because they're cowboy boots. And he goes, yeah, but you're not a fucking cowboy, are you, Mick? You're not a cowboy, are you, Mick? And Ronson just said, fair enough, and went back home.
And that was it.
And that was it. And that's great that the discussion is authenticity, that Ronson, you know, a field player, couldn't handle it.
Yeah. But then he was essential to Bowie. There's a lovely version of Width of a Circle where Mick is very, very new, and it just kind of peters out before the big doon, 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 like the big coda. But in that, you can just almost sense that there's this excitement, you know, something's on the horizon here. It's really, you know, it's really going to kick off now. And this is really the swan song of that. I mean, Mick Ronson didn't play with Bowie again, not until 93 in Black Tie, White Noise. But what a great farewell. So you've already mentioned Where Have All the Good Times Gone, which is a wonderful sign off. But then for me, the absolute highlight of the album is Sorrow. I mean, Sorrow, I think, is just beautiful. I mean, it's not a very well-known Merseybeat song, but it's kind of slightly apart, I think, from the rest of the album. I mean, is that a song that you have any particular fondness for, or not at all?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love it. You know, it is different because it's not a guitar number, specifically. It's got that lovely string section. And as a Beatles fan, I mean, my approach to pop was through comedy records, then I fell in love with the Beatles, then I had a couple of other things as well, but all I really knew were the Beatles. And so when I heard Sorrow, and it's like, with your long brown hair, long blonde hair and your eyes, I'm like, oh, wow, that's off. It's all too much.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yellow Submarine. Because I was that much of a Beatles fan. I had the Yellow Submarine soundtrack before it. But
that's really being a Beatles fan.
It's really much easier now with downloads. Yeah. But what's interesting, I've always had a thing about the Beatles and Bowie, which is this slightly arrogant, who needs crap thing, which is basically with the Beatles, different every album, different. By and large, change of image, change of look, new ideas, and the best group in the world. And it's the same with David Bowie for me. Every album, different, and the best solo artist. And it's always made it difficult for me with other bands. Because, like, why? I mean, I like the Rolling Stones, but why bother, you know? And I love The Who. But it's like, they've got to do something different. With the Beatles, have got songwriting covered, and Bowie had got Being an Alien covered. Or seriously, you know, or experiment in popular music. So I've always, tied them together in that way. But this, coming back to Pinups, is, on a lot of levels, you can say it's a mess, and people have criticised things like, I Can't Explain is a very slow version. And unless you, I think it helps not knowing the originals, because it's a great coherent sound. It's like a Chris Thomas production, almost. It's that big, chunky 70s sound. But everything Ronson plays, every intro, like Where Have All the Good Times Gone, that massive dang, dang, dang.
Yes.
Here Comes the Night, that hilarious kind of, you know, this is the only album where you'll talk about the guitars all the way through. And you're right about...
They're phenomenal, the guitars.
Yeah. Say. And he's given free reign.
Yeah.
Other Bowie albums, Aladdin Sane, to me, has got a thin production. Ziggy Stardust has got quite a quiet production.
Yeah, yeah. I've never been that impressed with Ziggy in terms of...
I like audio. Ziggy, but it's more of... It's a pop production. It's a radio production.
It's quite thin, though.
It is thin, I grant you that. But you look at the records that Ronson's on. Man Who Sold the World, insane sound. Mm. Changes, beautiful. Sorry, not Changes. Hunky Dory, yeah. Beautiful sound, but it's a piano album and an acoustic album. Ziggy, bit quiet. Aladdin Sane, a bit thin. But Pinups is like, it's almost a Sorry. Really? It's like, okay, this is a mix album.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I don't like about Pinups, and I can see where they did it because it doesn't fit, is it doesn't have White Light, White Heat on it. The Mick Ronson.
Why not? I mean, he was playing because
it's American.
Oh,
it's
really?
The one moment, because, you know, he was going to have other things on it. It's the one moment, and there are stories about he's going to do an American pinups and all this kind of stuff. But because it's American, it doesn't go on, it doesn't quite fit. I mean, I've got it on whichever Ronson album it's on, where he just gave him the backing track, and Ronson sings perfectly fine over it. But it's great, White Light, White Heat. The studio version is fantastic. And it would be nice if it was an extra track, but I can see why it doesn't fit.
The version on the live Ziggy album, I think, is absolutely killer.
Oh, that's amazing. I remember listening to Tommy Vance's Friday Rock Show in the late 70s, and they would play old John Peel sessions.
Right.
Because Peel didn't play them. It was the height of New Wave. He's not playing old stuff. And it's like, oh, now, I like David Bowie. And it was. It was White Light, White Heat, Waiting for the Man, Suffragette City.
Yeah.
It is them at their most velvets, and they're great.
Version, I think it's a Peel session of Waiting for the Man. It's just amazing when the guitar, when Ronson comes in, you know, he's almost like feeling his way into the song with the big crunchy guitar. I think about a quarter way through, it's just absolutely magic. So good.
And it's better, to be really new. It's better than the Santa Monica one, which is good, but quite slow.
Yeah.
But this session, for some reason, they're all just very fast versions. White Light, White Heat is a brilliant bit when he says, White Light makes me sing like Lou Reed.
It's a fantastic version. I think also for the pinups, he was talking about doing God Only Knows, which again would have kind of, you know, contravened the London theme.
God, an American album with God Only Knows and Waiting for the Man on it. Yeah. Sorry, White Light, White Heat. Yeah, I mean, I liked the Tonight version of God Only Knows.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I just love the song.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the Beach Boys version is fantastic. And rightly so, but I think he does a good job. It's his Scott Walker moment thinking about it. I mean, not always. It's when he's doing the cavernous voice.
It's that big croon, isn't it? Big chocolatey velvet croon.
My theory, I think he'd just, even though probably the times are wrong, he maybe just heard Climate of Hunter that day, or he just heard No Regrets. You could easily see God Only Knows following No Regrets on a compilation. No Regrets.
Last time you were here, we were talking, Pete Townsend came up. And Townsend's career did intersect with Bowie's career.
Yeah.
Had some pretty interesting moments to look at. So obviously around the mid-60s, the Who were a huge influence, you know, like the leaders of the mod scene. And can you just sort of, what do you think about Bowie's relationship with Townsend and how it's sort of like come in and out of his canon over the years?
It's bizarre because, of course, Bowie's a 60s failed pop star. So, you know, he's doing the same stuff. He's trying to be... like The Who. He starts off doing the same kind of R&B covers. The difference is he's a lot younger. And Townsend comes out the trap so articulate, talking about a lot of things that Bowie would talk about later, art in your relation of art to pop, painting to rock and this kind of thing. But he's really good at it. And he has a hit vehicle for it as well. And Bowie is just another face at the marquee. And the mod thing is much more of a closed thing. I mean, The Who aren't really mods. It was an image that suited... you know, sales, whereas Bowie was more of a clothes mod.
Really, the Who weren't mods in what sense? I mean, the image was very, very mod.
Well, they're mods in the sense that they dress like that, but mod... I mean, I have a massive theory about mod, that mod is great, but mod is the great leeching rock. Mod's a fashion, mod's a lifestyle. But unlike, say, rockabilly or rock and roll, and rockers in particular, or soul, it doesn't rely on making music, it's about consuming. You know, there's no great mod tailors. There are people who wear clothes. Mm. It's a silly theory in a lot of ways, but great mods. It's like The Who, not mods. The Small Faces, pretty good, and David Bowie and Mark Bolan, who were only great when they stopped being mods. But yeah, so when Pinups comes along, Bowie's paying tribute to everyone. He's already done a Stones cover on Aladdin Sane.
And that could easily have fit on here.
That could have fit in completely.
With a high velocity, just kind of frenetic approach they took.
Yeah, the only difference is that they do it in with Garson, so it's got that plinky plonk jazz, so I'm sure he'd love to hear it called all over it. But yeah, it would fit really well. You can see it coming on after Here Comes the Night. But the Who thing, so he's doing Who covers. It's a blatant Naked tribute. Then you've got Townsend is on Scary Monsters. He plays on, I think, Because You're Young, really great Suspended Chords, I believe they're called, at the start of a track. Ring, ding, 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 ding. Yeah, because Bowie likes guitarists. And then there's the weird thing with Heathen, where he does a song called 515, The Angels Are Calling, which he claims is related to hanging out and getting drunk with Pete Townsend, and probably is, but in a bit of a confused way. Yeah, Bowie and The Who, Bowie and Townsend go together. And yeah, I'm sure that Townsend has been influenced by Bowie as well.
Just to go back to a point you made earlier, Bowie and the Denim Heavy Rock Brigade were not entirely trusting of each other, especially in the early 70s. And yet Townsend is very much in this camp and Bowie is very much in that camp.
But Townsend is a brain, if you take it in that separation. I find it's interesting. You listen to the 70s Who, there's a track called Young Man Blues, which is a cover of a Mose Allison song. And it could be Led Zeppelin. It's exactly the same, a slow blues bit with a fast guitar. But everything else Townsend is writing, he's writing these little cameo songs. He's written Tommy, which, while it's a rock opera, is a very strange, very silly, very British thing. Townsend's a rock intellectual like Bowie is. You know, it's before the era of Brian Eno and David Byrne, when you could sit around and talk about art and not get bottled. Mm. But Townsend is a reader. Townsend went to art school. That's the other Bowie connection. He's obsessed with art. He understands pop art very early on. He understands commercial art. He understands The Who being a product, The Who sell out. Bowie got all that as well. And yeah, I think Townsend's musical openness sets him apart from Jimmy Page or Ritchie Blackmore. You know, he's not Ritchie Blackmore.
Another interesting guitarist who's referenced here is Jeff Beck. Of course, the another one of my personal favourites is the cover of Shapes of Things.
Yeah.
Which, of course, the Yardbirds were a huge band in the 60s on this scene. And I don't know about you, I really, really like this version. It's got that sort of strange, echoey, slightly psychedelic feel to it.
Well, Ronson's having a great time. Bowie's doing his Shapes. He's really doing the full Newly. It's one of those perfect covers that it's only when you hear the original you realise it doesn't actually sound like it.
Mm.
But it's a very good 70s cover.
It's a really good 70s cover. I do prefer it to the original. I mean, the original's a bit kind of, you know, limp after that preposterous big over-the-top.
It's difficult because you can never hear things in context. And, you know, we weren't around in the mid-60s when these records came out. They would have sounded amazing on the radio compared to, I don't know, Engelbert Humperdinck or Ken Dodd. Bowie did the right thing. He amped them up. I don't think he camped them up. That's kind of a nice thing. You know,
that's a very nice thing.
My favorite,
amped not camped.
Amped not camped. My favourite statistic I also discovered today was it came out the same day or charted the same day as Brian Ferry's These Foolish Things.
Which, of course, was his covers album.
Which is his covers album and is interesting because you've got the two intellectual art glam rock figures both releasing covers albums. And Ferry's is much more, well, it's a much bigger mixture from show tunes and cabaret songs. There's not much rock. It's mostly pop. Whereas Bowie's a slice of history. He picks a moment in time. You know, he doesn't have Dylan on it. Beatles aren't on it. No, the Beatles aren't on it. He picks the R&B scene of this era, whereas Ferry picks his whole record collection. And it's interesting. Yeah, they've both gone down in history as ironic camp people, but these are labours of love. He loves the songs. You know, Bowie and Ferry both love the songs on it. There's no archness to it.
And of course, with Ferry, it was the beginning of what would become quite a regular habit, releasing endless covers throughout his career to the present day.
But Bowie would do them for different reasons. You know, either he had songwriting problems or it was to give Iggy Pop some money.
Iggy's screwed again. We need to do China Girl.
I mean, there's so a point in the 80s when it's like, please stop doing Iggy Pop songs.
He's paid off the IRS now. It's okay. Yeah, his tax bill is fine until he screws it up again, and then you're going to have to do blah, 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 whatever.
Did I Wish You Would?
I Wish You Would is the Yardbirds.
It's the Yardbirds, isn't it? Yeah.
It's not, I mean, I love the Yardbirds. I just recently bought, because the Yardbirds are one of those weird bands, because they have three guitarists, they have three eras. They're a blues band, then they're a pop group. Eric Clapton leaves because they're too pop, and I love that because I loathe Eric Clapton. And they're a blues band at first. Eric Clapton's the first guitarist. Okay. They back blues singers, they do blues songs. Then they have pop songs written for them, mostly by Graham Goldman. And they're great, but Clapton doesn't enjoy it. Then Beck comes in, it's their psychedelic era.
Yes.
And they are fantastic. They're making great, great singles. Then that sort of peters out. They do some more pop stuff. And then Jimmy Page comes in. And eventually it becomes the new Yardbirds, then Led Zeppelin. But they're great at this point. They're becoming Led Zeppelin, but they're like a 60s beat group who are really loud.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I love the Yardbirds. I love the Pretty Things, and the Pretty Things have got Don't Bring Me Down on here.
Pretty Things are great. And then you've got Dick Taylor, who was the old Stones bass player, wasn't he?
He was a guitarist in the Stones, yeah. And in the Mekons.
In the Mekons?
Yeah, it means he's been in three of the best groups in the world, the Stones. And he was in the Mekons until he basically got too elderly. But yeah, I don't know the social connection, but yeah, it's quite extraordinary. The Pretty Things, one of the great... It's that thing about the Pretty Things was it was like, if you think the Rolling Stones are wild, wait till you see these guys. Exactly. And they were amazing. And again, they had this Spinal Tap career.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they were a great R&B band. They invented, well, the concept album with SS Sorrow, yeah, which is a brilliant record. Then they went in a rather sludgy 70s period. But I used to go and see them when they came back in the noughties. Fantastic shows. Really great band. And this does bring in a thing that one thing Bowie is the person who takes wherever he can. Mick Jagger famously said, never wear a new pair of shoes in front of him.
Wasn't that when Jagger was annoyed that he'd nicked Guy
Pearce? Yeah, exactly.
For the Diamond Dogs cover.
Exactly. Yeah. And took him off It's Only Rock and Roll, because he's singing backing vocals. But yeah, so one thing that Bowie's always taken is energy, either in the form of guitarists. So he's had mad screaming guitarists like Earl Slick, Mick Ronson, or Adrian Belew. But the other thing is, he doesn't leech off them, but he loves noisy bands. Mott the Hoople, the Velvet Underground, and the Pretty Things. And it's interesting because, you know, he's seen as this fey camp arch person. But he did love rock. He really loved it. And I think maybe there's some frustration that he found it hard to do, in the sense that he found it hard to just be unself-conscious.
Yeah.
He's not the kind of person to drink 10 pints, smoke a spliff, and then do a blues song.
And that was, again, coming back to this constant carping of Bowie in the mid-70s. Yeah, like you say, his demeanour was quite fey and quite, you know, delicate. But then when you listen to something like The Man Who Sold the World, which I think mainly due to Visconti is really muscly, and very dark and very dense. And I think certainly in the early 90s, I remember reading at the time of the Sound Vision tour, a lot of people were starting to look back at that album and say, oh, well, this was one of the first metal albums, which I don't personally buy, but it's like the same people say, well, Day Tripper was the first, no, Ticket to Ride was the first metal track, which I think is E. McDonald's sort of slightly preposterous theory. But he never quite cut it as a rock figure. I think that's part of the frustration that led to Tin Machine. Yeah. Was this sort of like, you know, for fuck's sake. All right, then, here you go. Okay, you want rock?
They were fine. Yeah, I mean, they just the songs were. But yeah, Tin Machine was, as Wayne's World said, a sore way to clear the palate. Yeah. After the 80s bands, you know, the 80s stuff, the plastic pop, it was just, what's the opposite of that? It's what we always do. What's the opposite of that? Dirty, tuneless racket. I'm a band, not a solo artist. Don't look at me.
Of course, that's going to work with David Bowie, isn't it? Just to wrap up on pinups, this is a great lineup. If there were, would there be like a handful of songs you would have loved to have heard him do, this band at that time?
Just thinking of songs that I liked. I guess Hey Bulldog by the Beatles. That would have been good. Maybe some more Who songs. I'd like to have heard him do Won't Get Fooled Again, even though it's a 70s song.
That's interesting.
I'd like to hear him do some. I mean, he foisted Sweet Jane on Mott the Hoople, and they do a very good version, but I'd like to hear him done some Lou Reed, Rock and Roll, maybe something like that.
Yeah, it kind of fell off after a while, didn't it? After more or less religiously doing White Light, White Heat and Waiting for the Man, then he didn't really do very much.
No, I mean, you've got you can do a great Lou Reed tape with him. You can do Queen Bitch, which is a Elvis copy, White Light, White Heat, Waiting for the Man, Sweet Jane with Mott, and there is a famous ropey demo of Lou Reed singing over it.
Really?
Yeah, it's fine. It's just very poor quality tape. But Lou Reed turned. And then, of course, there's the 50th concert, which is on YouTube, and you've got Bowie does Queen Bitch, Lou does New York, and they do Waiting for My Man, and they do it with a drum machine track. And Bowie is just so happy. He's virtually jumping into the verses ahead of Lou. He's so happy. He's basically with his rock dad for a day out.
It's lovely. Well, David, thank you so much for joining
me
today.
Well, it's a great time.
Pin-ups. And I'm going to be digging this one out again, actually, and giving you a good listen tonight. So, yeah, thanks
for that. Magic, thank you. What a good time.
And that was David Quantick and myself getting to grips with the magnificent pinups, which I'm now really tempted to buy again on vinyl from Amazon, having read the breathless reviews regarding the recent vinyl repress. I think I already have it on about 3 different formats, but hey, you know, lovely new sleeve and everything. Anyway, that's all. Not only is this the last part of the podcast, but it's the last podcast I'll ever do. No, I'm only kidding. But this is indeed the last Album to Album, the podcast, for a while, as I'm going to be off recording the next batch of interviews, which should be online in about a month or so from now. So till then, I really want to thank everyone who's tweeted, texted, emailed, and messaged their support and reactions to the series so far. It's been really lovely getting such a positive response. So do keep in touch at Album to Album on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And until we meet again, a very civilized springtime to all of you. Thank you and bye.